You are tuned in to Community Radio, WPVMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Showers and possibly a thunderstorm today, with a high in the upper 60s to near 70. Patchy fog late tonight into Monday morning. Partly cloudy skies overnight, the low around 50. Becoming sunny on Monday with a high of 74. Partly cloudy skies overhead Monday night with a low in the upper 40s to near 50. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville, 103.7.
Welcome to the Resilience Realm, a syndicated radio program airing on WPVM FMLP 103.7, Radio Asheville and the Pacifica Network. The show airs on Sundays at 10 a.m. EST from Asheville, North Carolina. Your host is Dawn Westmoreland, a Resilience keynote speaker, HR professional, author, life coach, and retired Air Force veteran. On the Resilience Realm, Dawn amplifies powerful voices, including employment attorneys, mental health professionals, veterans, employees, employers, and community leaders who share practical resilience strategies. They discuss tips for moving forward to find the strength to seek support when systems fail. Here is your host, Dawn Westmoreland.
Welcome back. I'm so happy to be here today. I have Beth Russo, who is in Asheville, North Carolina, and a shout out to her husband, Todd Weatherly, who also has a radio show. Beth, what's his show called right now?
Mental Health Matters.
Yes, that's a big one. So mental health does matter. I'm going to play off of that because today we live in a world that is very divided. There's so much controversy, whether it's politics, whether it's religion, whether it's skin color, so much out there. And one thing I know as a life coach is that a lot of people need to build their resiliency muscles. And I'll be the first one to say that I do too. So I wanted to bring on Beth because she has quite the story of overcoming her family. She has three sons. I admire that so much, raising three boys, because I grew up with seven brothers and stepbrothers, and I was in the Air Force with a bunch of men. Beth, hello, and how are you today?
I'm great. It's so wonderful to be here with you today, Dawn. Thanks for having me on.
It is. Let's start off with going back, and you were telling me your son went through some debilitating times, and you had to grow your resiliency muscles, and you're still working and trying to have a family, you know, run efficiently. That's the best way.
Efficient it is, but I've certainly, I have an incredible kid. His name is Luke, and he was my second child. I actually only have two sons, but he was my second boy, and we found out in the eighth month of pregnancy that he had a skeletal condition, at that point unknown, that made both his femurs and humerus bones about 20% shorter than average. And that day in the ultrasound office, my doctors and midwives were all at a conference. And I knew that the technician was being kind of vague about something, but I just was not picking up what she was putting down. And she said, finally, I'm calling your midwife so you can talk to her about this. She's at this conference. And my midwife said to me, and literally took me to my knees, how do you feel about your son having dwarfism? Which was not in my radar, not family history. I've since learned that 80% of people who are born with dwarfism are born to family members who are normal size. And at the initial point of that diagnosis, and again, I'm 8 months pregnant, I'm almost ready to have this kid, they were like, he could be profoundly developmentally disabled, some forms of dwarfism, children don't make it past their third birthday. And so for about 28, 30 hours until I could get into the specialist with the ultrasound, I really had to wrestle with, am I the kind of person who can raise a profoundly developmentally delayed child? What am I going to do if this kid's going to die before he turns three? It was not my favorite time of life, to say the least, Dawn. It was pretty horrifying and cried a lot. And then we went to the specialist, and the specialist was able to get in there with the ultrasound and say, guess what? You know, your son's brain is perfectly normal. Hallelujah. His heart's perfectly normal. Basically, everything is perfectly normal except for his skeletal system, which is a mess. And he's actually been through genetic testing up at DC Children's Hospital. He's had genetic testing done here, and they were never able to identify what he has. He's been tested for 93% of the known disorders, but he's a new special kid with his own special one. And that was, you know, that's just the way it is. You know, initially he was born, no problem. He was extremely small, that we were already prepared for that. And then when he was 8 years old and he was getting regular visits to, you know, specialists, when he was about 8 years old, one day he was changing his shirt and I noticed he had this prominent sticking out of his side. So I mentioned it to his doctor next time. And it also turned out that it, not only at eight was he developing extreme scoliosis, which is a twisting and a curvature of the spine. But we also found out one afternoon that his growth plates were literally about to slip off the top of his femurs. He'd got an x-ray. Poor kid's eight. I'm like, we're going to go out and get lunch and cupcakes after this x-ray, you know, kind of bring joy. Because part of developing resilience is finding your joy, I think. And we were walking out the door and they started shouting my name. Our surgeon was off that day. And it turned out they were like, if he had jumped out of the car, it could have sheared off the top of his femurs. Didn't even know that such a thing existed. And by that evening at 7 o'clock, he was having emergency surgery and 8 years old. I think it was like a Wednesday. I was, you know, in the middle of my work week. And, you know, Don, one of the things I've learned through some of the hard times, because that was one of his two surgeries, is that your community coming to you, around you, makes things tolerable, things that you don't think you can tolerate. And I think that's part of resilience, too, is that when we are faced with a crisis, whether it's your kid having a medical issue or a devastating crime or a financial crisis, you know, we could list about 1,000 different possible crises for people. A lot of times our first response is to freeze and to think, I can't. And one of the things that helps you say, at least for me, to say I can is having that support of my loved ones. And whether it was friends bringing food or family members just texting me cards. My boss at the time, his wife was a chaplain at Mission, and he made arrangements for her to come and sit with us. You know, those kinds of things are small little moments, but they really meant a lot to me at that moment. And that was, you know, part of both my resiliency, but Lucas's too, because again, he was 8 years old. He didn't ask for any of this. He's just a kid. And I hope I can say this, but he's a badass and he's been through stuff that would bring adult men and women to their knees. He had been through that stuff before he was even 18 years old.
I can't imagine what you went through because, you know, for fun, when I got out of the Air Force 21 years ago, I earned a horticulture degree. And one of the girls in my class had a son who was a dwarf. And I learned a lot about dwarfism from her. And sadly, she passed on a couple years ago with cancer. So You had help. Did you have, I'm curious, because some people have a hard time asking for help. Did you have a hard time asking for support and help and resources, Beth?
Yeah. And I'm curious. I'm a military kid and we're used to like, just figure it out, do it yourself. I'm Gen X. We were kind of the latchkey generation. So we were really, you know, I'm really used to like, oh, I have to do this all by myself. Mm-hmm. And actually I think that's a little bit of a character flaw at times because I've had to humble myself to accept help and support because people genuinely wanted to give it to me and it genuinely was helpful. But I had this idea that if I took it, I was taking something that somebody else might need more than me. Isn't that weird?
Do you think women have a hard time in general asking for help?
I do. And I think, you know, for us who've been in the generations where we've worked as normal, you know, being a working woman's a normal thing for our age range. We've had kids, we have parent care work to do, we have community obligations, and we're really bad about, I think, taking more and more things on our shoulders until either we collapse or we hand off some things.
You know, Beth, we talked recently in the past week, and you said you wanted to address burnout in women. And that's so funny because later that day, I met somebody that's going to be on the radio show and they're talking about burnout. I said, oh my gosh, do you know Beth Russo? Yes, it was Jen Alley. You may know Jen Alley.
Oh, yeah. I do know Jen.
Yeah, she's abroad right now, but I just talked to Jen. I said, what a perfect subject because women are always, always going, doing. And Do you ever feel like you're not doing enough? I mean, I think so many women do. Yeah. I mean, even I do feel that way.
Certainly do. And I've also spent most of my career in either education or helping in nonprofit worlds, which are usually less resourced, more responsibilities added regularly with no increase in pay or help. So I think it is our society has really created a wonderful, cauldron of burnout, particularly for women who are trying to excel in their careers, trying to excel as a parent and a wife or a spouse or a girlfriend, or maybe they're single and doing it alone, but they're still trying. Then they're trying to hold multiple roles. They're trying to still support their community, take care of their health. I mean, I joked one day with somebody when we were talking about self-care practices when I was an executive director and was working 65 hours a week. And I remember the person saying to me, well, you just need to carve out this much time for your health and your sleep and your relationship and alone time. And I was adding up all the things that they wanted me to do in the 24 hours that I was also supposed to be working and sleeping. And I was like, this is 36 hours of stuff I'm supposed to fit into 24 hours. And somehow that's supposed to make me feel better. I do think our culture supports that. I think women tend to be helpers. I don't think only women are. And I think, I know that I'm 58 years old, so my experience is different than someone who's 28 years old. But I do think we've been conditioned for a long time to meet whatever the community's needs are and to meet our family's needs. And, you can see it when you're looking at caretaking. I can say that, I know that at my kids' school, if something happened at school, they always called me, not my husband, that kind of thing. So I think that we have a culture that loves to stack stuff on women's shoulders and we trained ourselves to accept that load without help and feel like a failure when we can't carry it.
So how do we change that where we're not carrying so much, but we're still feeling good about ourselves, our contributions to the world, Beth?
As a, probably the million-dollar question, probably the billion-dollar question, I do think part of it is starting to really focus on what your priorities and values are. I realized that I often said yes to things that weren't very important to me because somebody else needed it. And I think one of the things that I had to address, and I'm probably addressing this till I die, is my own people-pleasing tendencies. And I think that's very intersectional with my military upbringing, because I mentioned to you, I went to 9 schools in 12 years. I was always the outsider. I never knew the culture. I was always showing up in a school where everybody else had been to school since they were in kindergarten. And I started 4 weeks late as the weird one. So, wanting to please people, pretty natural survival skill, I think. And it really is just it's so built into women in all kinds of ways. So I think looking at your values and saying to yourself, do I really want to volunteer on this board? Just because, these people think I would be great. Do I want to do this? Do I want to go out? Do I want to do this book club? Looking at your values and how you spend your time. This is a hard one too, saying no and saying not yet. I don't like to say no, especially if it's a good cause or a good person or someone I really like, but I just can't say yes to everything. And so sometimes what I tell people is not yet. It pushes the yes or no later on. They know I'm still caring about what they're doing, but I'm not adding to my own workload. And then I think two other things. One, learning how to say no related to what doesn't fit your values or your goals. I get asked, I don't know about you, but I'm asked to be on boards a lot. And I used to always say yes, because I wanted to be helpful. And now I say no, or I'm going to think about it for 3 months. And if it's not in alignment, it's easy for me to say, nope, this is just not my passion. I'm not going to do it. I don't need to worry about building my resume. I don't even know how much that really helps your resume, to be honest with you. And then boundaries. That's a hard one too.
Boundaries is a very good subject, and I love the people please. And let's touch on boundaries. I can't wait to hear you.
I think it's so, let's start off like when my kids went to school in kindergarten, I'd been volunteering in other places. I'd never volunteered at a school. I went to the PTA meeting because I was a new mom of a kindergartner. And by the time I left that meeting, I had a position on the PTA association. Again, my first meeting. And I had signed up to go and solicit all these items for the carnival that happened later in the year. And I came home and I was like, why did I do all this? You know, like I just added like 20 hours a month of work to my load, and I have two little kids and a full-time job. And so it's so hard once you've said yes one time to say no the second time. And I encourage a lot of women to practice saying no and just leaving it at that. A lot of us find that very painful. We want to explain or soften it. But, you know, I also, you mentioned my husband, Todd, who we've been together for 31 years. And one of the things I've learned from him is no's a complete sentence. And sometimes that's the most helpful thing you can do for yourself and the other person. And I swear that was like learning a foreign language. And I'm not very good at it, but I keep practicing it. And sometimes I've learned too that if you don't hold your bound, like I'm on one board that I'm leaving shortly. And I had told them a year ago after my term was up that I was ready to leave. And they asked me to stay. And I did. And finally, I was like, they're never going to have me get off the board. And so I just told them, hey, 3 months from now, that's my last meeting. It was fine. Everybody was like, thank you for what you've done. But if I hadn't said that, set that limit with them and that boundary with them, I'm pretty sure I would be on that board till I died. And
you were an asset.
Yep. But just, I think it's so common. It's just so easy to say yes. And again, if you're good at stuff, usually you get asked even more. And if you're not careful, you say yes to everything. And then you're not good at stuff because you can't do everything to as high of a quality level.
Mm-hmm. Beth, you're a go-getter. You're a high achiever. And I've really gotten to know you in the last couple of years through the radio station. And I've known your husband a while back through different meetup groups and such. And I want to ask you, how do you start your day to set the tone for your day? Because you know you're on boards, you have commitments, you have family, and I made your family bigger than I should have. I think what I thought was one of the sons, it was probably a friend in a picture I've seen, maybe it's a friend of one of your children. I thought you had three boys, so I made your family a lot bigger. But how do you start your day? How do you start your day to be able to have enough energy and desire for the day, for the outcomes?
I would love to be a great morning person. And to be honest with you, I'm not a morning person. I'm one of those people who, you know, like my mom goes to bed sad and wakes up happy. I wake up sad and get happy as the day goes on. Coffee is always the start of my day. And if I'm lucky, Todd brings it to me in bed. I used to scroll through my phone and look at news, and I have been working on breaking that habit for the last year because it does not add anything good to my life. I usually run through what I'm doing that day, making sure like, oh, I need to make sure I think of this, sort of just a mental schedule check. And then one of the things I've been doing lately, because the news in the world is bad, and I feel like it's inundating me everywhere. So I usually start with 10 things I'm grateful for. And not like giant things like, I don't know, you know, I'm not saying thank you for my entire life. I'm thanking being grateful for my cup of coffee. I'm grateful that I have a home. I'm grateful that I have a loved one who brings me coffee. And I'm grateful that I have work to go do that I enjoy. But a lot. So that's a lot of it. I would love to be one of those people, like I said, who gets up and maybe meditates and, you know, but that's my version of it. You know, gratitude. And not scrolling through the news. One of the substitutes I did to stop myself from scrolling from the news was I picked up a crossword puzzle app. So instead of looking at whatever is happening in the world, I'm like, oh, what's a five-letter word for feline? You know, that kind of thing. So it's changed the way I orient my day. And it does actually help because I'm not starting off gloomier than my own nature leads me to be.
Yeah. And there are a lot of people out there, they want to know what's going on in the world because it obviously is rippling effect. It influences no matter what's going on. But what would you say is a healthy version of keeping up with the news, whether it's online or on TV? Your opinion, because your opinion matters.
I generally look at headlines. So I go and look at NPR, BBC, and CNN to see what they have out there. The reason I go to the BBC is because it's, you know, a little more global and The news seems like, you know, if you go to one station in the United States, a lot of times it's the same headlines across all of them. BBC often gives you some information outside. I go look at a local news source, usually another radio station or our local TVs, just to see what the headlines are locally. And then lately, you know, pop on Facebook for a few minutes in the morning sometimes, or I look at Reddit. I like Reddit's something new to me. I just started doing that last year when there was wildfires right behind our home, and I could not get information from the county about whether we needed to evacuate or not. And so I went to Reddit, which is where I got information about the, like detailed information about what was happening with that. And I wouldn't say that's necessarily an excellent source of news, but it sure gives you a bunch of local feeds of stuff that might be happening out in New Mexico that I wouldn't hear about otherwise. One of the requests of my husband, and this is one of his setting boundaries, was that I don't tell him any of the bad news until after 10 a.m. and a full cup of coffee. Because I am a little bit of like
that.
So that his boundary helped me. Yeah.
Don't tell him any bad. He's not a morning person either.
No. And he was just like, it's a little bit too much to come out and hear this stuff before I've had a chance to even, like, you know, get out of my pajamas. So his boundary helped me set my boundary.
I love it. I'm laughing so hard because, you know, I'm dealing with siblings right now and life estate, things like that. Of course, everybody has a different opinion. And it's like, it's so funny because I'm thinking, God, I don't want to read any of this until I have 3 cups of coffee because, you know, we see things so very starkly different. Of course, they're brothers.
Yes.
You know, of course, we're going to see things different because we are different and such. Well, going forward, Beth, what are your plans for the future with your career? Are you going to stay a nonprofit? Are you looking to be hired, or are you looking to hire people with whatever endeavors you're going through?
Well, I have been a nonprofit for the bulk of my professional career, and I was an executive director at a local nonprofit and burnt out hard. I was, to be honest with you, I was burnt out before the hurricane hit us in, was that 2024, right? Yeah, it was 2024.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Yeah.
Hard to believe. So I was, I really crashed and burned myself, and I have a lot of things I've learned from that. But what I started doing last year was consulting with nonprofits through my business. It's called People Who Help. And I named it that because I like to help people, and I like to help people who are helping other people. And my nonprofit career has mostly been in poverty adjacent work and housing. So usually seeing lots of people in crisis. And so People Who Help was something I founded because I wanted to support other people who were doing this good work when I felt like I couldn't anymore. I work with clients to help them have robust organizations, and particularly around fundraising, to coach leaders to bring out their best. I'm doing burnout prevention and recovery work with some of the clients because burnout is such a prevalent issue in the nonprofit world. And I find that very alarming because the things that we expect to see movement happening around, people helping folks who are homeless, you know, removing invasive species or feeding hungry people or taking care of puppies on the who are abandoned on the side of the road. You need people in nonprofits to do that work because as a nation, we have decided that our government does not do that work. Our nonprofits are all mostly funded individually, and they take a lot of really good-hearted people who often are new in their careers and who are leading with their hearts, and then they burn themselves out too. And I think there's something like 75% of nonprofit leaders are deeply concerned about burnout in their staff right now. And I tell you, if everybody leaves teaching, public school teaching and nonprofits, society as we know it is not going to continue. So we have to take care of those people who are caring for others or for caring for bigger causes. And so burnout prevention and recovery, helping folks set their own boundaries, helping folks prioritize their work so that they're not spending 65 hours in the office. Those are some of the things that bring me a lot of joy right now.
Yes, yes.
Comes along, maybe, but, you know, mostly I just really want to keep supporting the people who are doing the critical work.
Yeah. And those are long hours. My goodness. I don't miss those kind of hours anymore. Well, let's talk about how can people find out more about you, you know, your contact information as we get down to the last few minutes.
Sure. So my name's Beth Russo, and you can find me on LinkedIn. You can also find me through my website, which is peoplewhohelp.org. I mean, you can email me at beth@peoplewhohelp.org. And I always tell people, you know, because I have people who have reached out about a particular, a lot of fundraising consulting, burnout consulting, that kind of thing, and they're worried about taking up my time. I give a free consultation to everybody. You know, if you think it might be a fit, let's talk. If it's not, no worries at all. But that said, that's how they can reach me.
That's very generous of you, Beth. Thank you for doing that, because it does have a rippling effect on all of us. You were talking about puppies on the side of the road, and I know how many times I've gone to our local, like, Brother Wolf and adopted a cat. I've adopted cats over the years, and now I have dogs and things like that. And it really does have a rippling effect. So somebody listening in and they know somebody who's working a nonprofit, or they're in a nonprofit and they're starting to experience burnout, what would be your first thing that you would address with them?
First things I do with folks who are experiencing burnout is we look at if they've taken their PTO. The number of people who just let their PTO dissipate over the year, I think it's not a unique to nonprofits, it's an American phenomenon. We don't use our vacation time. Well, if you don't get a break, and I don't mean like a long weekend, that's not a long enough of a break. Research shows that you really need like 3 weeks away to fully reset the mind. Most of us cannot get a 3 week vacation, but a lot of, you know, but if you haven't been taking your week, let's start with that. We start looking at workload to see what they could drop to the bottom of the pile. And I also like to find out what's that life-giving, what gives you energy in life. So I like to be active. I like to be outside. If I'm in a bad spot, take me outside. 30 minutes later, I'm resilient and happy and ready to go again. And I think a lot of it is finding where people can get joy and renewal from. So I'm kind of assessing the whole situation. And what I hear all the time is, oh, I have 6 weeks of PTO that I'm going to lose by the end of the year, but I can't take it off because XYZ is coming down the road. And what I tell them is like, well, would you give up a week of your pay for your organization? And most people would be like, no, I can't. This is your part of your compensation package. Take it. But also, because if you take it and you have that true break and you come back and you're smiling and you're ready to get back to work, it has another ripple effect. It changes the team and you're going to be more productive and effective. And that's the other thing I tell folks is that, you know, it's easy to get paralyzed. And a lot of times having someone else who's not in it with you, who can kind of have that clear eagle eye vision for what's happening on the bigger scale, you can help people come back out and regain their confidence, regain their resiliency and their equilibrium, and continue to do the work that they love.
Beth, I'm really glad you talked about PTO, personal time off. And I'll tell you why, because, you know, as I said earlier, I've been an HR person for 33 years. And I can go back to my time in the Air Force. And I did love him. He was a boss named Greg. I won't say his last name, but Greg was a workaholic, and he would actually come in on his leave and still work. And he would tell us his wife didn't want him around, and like, we don't want you around either. We need a break from you. But, you know, but it taught me a lot of things. You know, it taught me that that's what I might have to do when I become a supervisor. That's not a good example. And I can even step back and push that back years later when I was a supervisor and I'd eat at my lunch desk and I would get scolded by people, my mentors above me. And they're like, do you see what kind of tone you're setting for the people underneath you? Oh, become a supervisor or superintendent manager so you can work at your desk during lunchtime every day. And that's, I needed that kick in the butt. Beth, I needed that. And that taught me something that, you know, we're always on parade, never know who's watching us. So as we're down to the last minute, do you have anything that you want to add to this conversation?
Well, life is short. It goes by fast. And I think most of us have a purpose here. And I think if you can spend a little time looking at your purpose, what brings you joy and where you can be effective, your life is just, quality of life is just better. I really believe my purpose is to make the world a better place. And so that guides a lot of my decisions. And it gives me a lot of energy that I need to do that work. I think the other thing I want to mention is we started off talking about resilience, and we've kind of talked about many things, but resilience to me is a muscle. And, you know, if you've ever gone to work out for the first time after being sedentary, that's usually a pretty difficult workout those first few times. And you come home and you're like shaking and you can barely stand up straight. Same thing with resilience. You'll have a crisis that faces you and you think, I can't possibly do this. But as you continue to lean into it,